This is Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm here with Dave Schwartz. Our special guest today is environmentalist and best-selling author Bill McKibben. A former staff writer for The New Yorker, Mr. McKibben is a frequent contributor to The Atlantic Monthly, Mother Jones, Orion Magazine, and Tom Dispatch. Among Mr. Kibben's many books is the classic The End of Nature, which is considered the first book on global warming for the general audience. It's been translated into more than 20 languages, and an updated edition was published this year. Mr. McKibben is a scholar in residence at Middlebury College. His new book, coming out next spring, is entitled Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future. Although much of Mr. McKibben's writings concern the environment, we're going to begin our discussion today with a book he wrote on a very different subject, the subject of Christmas, and the book is entitled $100 Holiday, The Case for a More Joyful Christmas. Mr. McKibben, thanks very much for joining us. In your book, you wrote, Christmas had become something to endure, at least as much as it had become something to enjoy. Could you expand on that?
Sure. If you poll people this time of year, and people have done it, what you find is that something like three-quarters of Americans dread the approach of the holidays instead of viewing them with anticipation. And the reason's pretty obvious. You know, it's just another dose of busyness in an already too busy way of life. There's too much money, too much time, too much craziness. I think what's going on more than anything else is that we're following an old strategy. The idea that more stuff equals a better, happier life, it becomes magnified at Christmas, and so too, therefore, becomes magnified the fact that this strategy, which used to work, no longer does work for us. We've reached a point of saturation with stuff, and now what we really want and need is time and contact with each other and with the natural world.
So who was the Grinch that stole Christmas?
Well, it was a long process, of course, but in recent years, in recent decades, clearly the force that's driving our celebration of Christmas is a kind of consumer merchandising complex that tells us over and over again what constitutes a proper Christmas and what we'd be bereft without. And, you know, in the absence of some other set of clues, then we pay attention to the Walmarts and the Targets and the Norelcos and whoever else it is. It turns out, though, that if people are given permission, say by their pastors in church, to celebrate Christmas in a different way, people jump at the opportunity. That's what we've found anyway with this $100 holiday campaign that we've done.
In $100 Holiday, you talk about how the Christmas we know today was really invented in the 19th century. Could you talk about that?
Yeah. Christmas, you know, has obviously been around a long time, 2,000 years. But our current celebration of it, the one that consists mostly of awarding each other presents, is an American invention and a relatively recent one. Has something to do with wanting to tame what had been a rather subversive and even Saturnalian holiday, and much to do with wanting to provide an outlet for consumerism. It grew rapidly in the 19th and especially the 20th century, and it's now, as I say, reached a proportion where it no longer satisfies people all that much.
You said that Clement Moore, the writer, actually had a lot to do with the transformation of Christmas into the modern Christmas.
Yes, of course, his famous tale, A Night Before Christmas, was one of the earliest kind of depictions of what we now come to think of as a normal Christmas.
Well, how do you and your family celebrate Christmas in a way that's more joyful?
Well, I guess we try to think of it, in a sense, as someone else's birthday, Jesus's birthday. So I guess we treat it like a birthday. Instead of expecting presents for ourselves, although we give each other small things, we have a great deal of fun figuring out what we can do for other people, what small things we can make for our friends and neighbors and family. Generally, we take our money and give it to some worthy cause, and then give people symbolic gifts. Last year, for instance, since we were giving money to support environmental efforts, we made little Christmas tree candies out of maple sugar, maple syrup that we'd helped brew ourselves the spring before in the woods where we live. And that was extremely much fun. And to judge from the reaction of the people we sent them to, precisely what people wanted. And we've now reached the point where many people are sending us the same kind of gifts every year.
So your new approach is spreading amongst your friends and acquaintances from church?
Yes, indeed, and spreading in many other places, too. I mean, there's two kinds of Christmases going on now, an ever larger kind of Walmart Christmas. That trend is still there, but there's also this counter trend of lots of people who are thinking of new ways about doing things. One of the best places to go for people who want more information about this is the website of the Center for a New American Dream, newdream.org, which has done a lot of work with these alternative Christmas celebrations.
So this is Dave. So is Santa Claus the Grinch that stole Christmas?
St. Nicholas? No, not really. I think much more it's the idea that what Santa Claus brings needs to bring is not good cheer and you know, a stick of candy and all of that, but instead a huge sack bulging with stuff. Once upon a time, when Americans were materially poor and deprived, that bulging sack was probably worked pretty well to make us happier.
A lump of coal would be a very useful thing.
A lump of coal would be not a useful thing. I spend most of my life working on climate change, and the last thing we want
more
is anybody
fossil fuels.
Burning lumps of coal.
No, I'm thinking back in the days when people didn't have anything else.
Well, maybe.
Yeah, well, now, the Christmas we celebrate it now is based on consumerism, and as you point out, consumerism is about making you the center of the world, and that was one of the observations you made from your book, The Age of Missing Information.
Yes.
Could you talk about your television research in that?
Well, that was an odd book. I found the largest cable television system in the world, which was then in Fairfax, Virginia. It had 100 channels, and I got people to tape for me everything that came across them for a 24-hour period, so I had 2,400 hours worth of videotape. I took it back with me to the mountains where I live, and I went to Sears and got a recliner, and I settled in for a year and watched. And there were all kinds of interesting observations if you sort of tried to figure out what the world would look like to you if this was the aperture through which you viewed it. That book, The Age of Missing Information, has just been reissued, and it really is in many ways my favorite of my books. But the basic idea that comes through that coaxial cable, and indeed through most of the organs of our consumer culture, is that you're the most important thing on Earth. You know, you're the center of the universe, the heaviest object. Things should orbit around you. We're so used to that idea that we've come to call it human nature. But in fact, though it's part of human nature, it's only a part, and it's just our intense focus, schooling of ourselves on that idea in the last few decades that's led us to think that it's the be-all and the end-all.
What sort of programs were you looking at?
Oh, you name it. You know, everything. Right down to the Richard Simmons infomercials.
Well, not everyone has embraced the American lifestyle, and you say that in your worldwide travels, you have found proof that there are less damaging ways to lead satisfying human lives, evidence that our infatuation with accumulation and expansion is not the only possibility. That's from your book, Hope, Human and Wild. And you visited, there are two places that you visited that are you discuss in great detail in that book. One is Curitiba, Brazil, a fairly large city in Brazil. Could you talk about what you observed there?
Sure. I was looking for places, and there aren't that many that lie outside our more is better idea of things. Curitiba is a city of about 3 million people in the south of Brazil, near the headwaters of the Iguaçu River. Completely fascinating place. Not particularly rich, certainly by our standards, per capita income of a few thousand dollars a year, but in some ways the most livable city on the planet. It has, well, just as an example, a truly fantastic bus system, the best on earth. Partly that's technological. You know, the mayor, who's an architect, sat down one day and watched the buses coming and going and tried to figure out why they were going slowly, why it took so long. And he watched everybody walk up the steps and put their quarter in the box and go to the back. And it's quickly designed and had built around the city these bus stations where you walk up on a platform, put your quarter in, wait for the bus to come. And when it does, the doors open like they would on a subway. You can load 20 people a minute, a second, on and off these buses. So the technology is a little bit of it. Much more is the willingness to make real change. In that city, you know, there are dedicated bus lanes. The traffic lights turn green for buses when they approach. It's a bad place to drive a car. It's a terrific place to ride a bus, and everyone does. As a result, people there in Curitiba use about 25 or 30% less fossil fuel than other urban Brazilians. That's pretty important in a world that's struggling to figure out how to deal with things like global warming.
Now, the mayor, I believe his name is Lerner.
Yes, Jaime Lerner.
He came up with this idea before he was mayor in the 60s, and they were confronting the necessity of growth. And wasn't the problem was that they had to make certain changes in their city to accommodate growth, and he was trying to come up with different ideas?
Absolutely. They had on the books the standard plan, you know, tear down parts of the central city, put an expressway through, all the things that have disfigured so many American cities. But instead, Lerner said, no, we're going to approach this differently. In fact, he built there in Curitiba what was really the first pedestrian mall any place in the world, except maybe the old quarter of Munich. He did it in a weekend, tore up all the pavement, put down cobblestones. People protested for a few hours, but then they noticed how many more people were suddenly walking around town and things like that. Within a day, other parts of the city were asking if they too could have their streets torn up and be turned into pedestrian malls. It's a very remarkable place. He's a remarkable man, but none of the things that he's doing are beyond the reach of our communities or other communities.
He also seems to have created an economically sustainable city because he also was looking at the job growth and they developed a new industrial zone, correct?
Yes, it's an attractive enough place now because it's unlike the rest of urban Brazil, that they've had very large success attracting other industries to come there.
He also had a very interesting way of approaching the lack of housing because, like other cities, I understand his city was being inundated with many poor people coming in from the rural areas, and he came up with a novel way of giving away land.
Well, they bought some of the last remaining open land within the city and then quickly reparceled it out in very small parcels to arriving peasants before they could sort of become, you know, build shanty towns on the edge of town. Instead, they each got an eighth or a tenth of an acre, and with it, a small pile of bricks and a small pile of boards and some help from the local architecture school about how they might design and build their own houses. And within a couple of years, there were thousands upon thousands of different houses sprung up in these new working communities. And of course, the first thing that went up was the fast bus line to connect them into the central city.
Oh, so they could get to jobs.
Exactly right.
So these people were building their own houses.
That's correct.
And the out-of-pocket costs were fairly modest, I would guess.
Yeah, because no one has any money.
Do you think this could be used to revitalize older American cities?
Well, something like it certainly could happen, and we see examples of interesting things beginning to go on in some of our most wasted cities. In Detroit, for instance, where sort of urban farming and urban homesteading is beginning to replace some of the vacant lots and burned out lots that dot so much of that city.
Well, now leaving Brazil, you traveled in India, and in Kerala, you saw a much different type of community, a less urban community, and you used a wonderful phrase, living lightly on the earth, to describe the people there. Could you talk about that community?
Yeah, sure. Kerala is a fascinating place without meaning to, without any environmental intent. They're a remarkably ecological place simply because they've managed to build a decent life without using much in the way of resources. There's about 30 million people there, so the equivalent of the population of California, in a very small area, not much larger than Vancouver Island. So extremely dense, but very green. It's mostly village, just dense village going on as far as you can see. People there are poor even by Indian standards. Per capita income is a few hundred dollars a year. But their life expectancy is essentially equivalent to America's. Their literacy rate, including their female literacy rate, is higher than ours. Their infant mortality rate is only a tad higher, and their birth rate is lower than ours and falling faster. It's a kind of statistical anomaly in many ways. And there's plenty of reasons for that. One of them is that it's had the most thorough land reform of any place in the world. There are very few large holdings and very many small holdings. Another is that there's a long tradition of education and empowerment of women there, which has put them, in a very good place. So it's quite remarkable.
Well, coming back home, you say, I am convinced that we need to change many of our habits. That's in I Hope Human and Wild. In what way do you think American families can and should change their habits?
Well, I think it's both American families and American societies. You know, I've been working longest in my career on questions of global warming and questions that become more pressing with each passing month. Americans, 5% of the world's population, use 25% of the world's energy. And it's because of the ways in which we live. Extremely large houses, extremely large cars, extremely long commutes, all reflections of an individualism bred by the access to cheap fossil fuel. We need to change those habits as best we can ourselves, i.e., buy more economical cars, figure out how to drive them less, whether by carpooling or using public transit. We need to change the ways in which we heat and power our homes. I mean, mine, even though I live in the mountains in Vermont, is covered with solar panels and solar hot water heaters. There's a lot of things like that we need to do. But we also need to figure out how to force the political change that'll make those actions count on a large enough scale to matter. That's what I'm working hardest on at the moment. In fact, people who are interested in trying to join this sort of nascent U.S. climate movement might want to visit the website we've set up recently. Go to stepitup07.org.
That's stepitup07.org.
And our goal is a set of demonstrations across the country in April of this year to try to get Congress to actually move off the dime, to step it up a little bit and begin to take the first actions that we need to take to deal with this dilemma.
A decentralization seems to be an important theme of the changes you foresee. Most people are forced to live in urban or suburban areas because of the proximity to jobs. How would they possibly decentralize?
Well, I don't think people need to move. I mean, cities are a perfectly good place to live and be. In fact, in some ways, one of the most efficient parts of our could be one of the most efficient parts of our society. I do think that we need to figure out how to start making them more self-sufficient. A good example is food, say. At the moment, food travels 2,000 miles, the average bite, before it reaches your lips. That doesn't need to be the case. In a place like, say, New York, even 50 years ago, most of the food that New Yorkers ate came from upstate New York and from New Jersey, the Garden State. Much of that soil is still available to grow things in. In fact, there are large, large areas of old farmland growing into scrub forest now in those areas. We need to reconfigure the set of incentives that have built us a massive, highly industrialized Midwestern monoculture agriculture, and instead replace it with one that grows food that people want to eat close to home.
In Tom Dispatch, you wrote recently, the technology we need most badly is the technology of community. Could you talk about that?
Sure. You know, there's clearly a lot of technologies that will help us, wind and solar and things like that. But going back to my observations about individualism, it's very clear that we'd be helped most, I think, by learning how to do things together again. It's very difficult to have public transportation in a society that so exalts the individual automobile all the time, for instance. If you go look instead at Europe, which is somewhat more community-minded, which has been willing, say, to pay the taxes to build good cities or good public transit systems, and then also willing to take those buses and trains once they've built them, to sacrifice some increment of convenience for the pleasure and the usefulness of doing things together. If you look at Europe, they use 50% less energy per capita than America does. 50% is a big number before you begin to get any technological change at all. It's one of the things that makes it possible to imagine doing something about, say, climate change.
You had the opportunity to interview Al Gore when he became vice president. And in an interview, he told you the maximum that is politically feasible falls short of the minimum that is scientifically and ecologically necessary. Do you feel that, that's correct?
Well, it certainly was correct then and is correct now. And the tragedy of the Clinton administration was that we didn't, you know, nothing changed that much in that equation. The political feasibility didn't move an inch because there wasn't enough leadership. Now Al Gore is providing real leadership on these issues, and that equation is beginning to change some. After Katrina, after An Inconvenient Truth, after some of these other things, we've begun to see in the polls and in the politics a swing towards some willingness to tackle these questions.
If you were president, what would be your top priorities?
It would be a bad idea to make me president. But, I mean, I think there's no question that the largest threat America faces is climate change, not terrorism, not any of the other things we've spent our time and money on. The only civilization-scale challenge that humans are up against at the moment is global warming. To deal with it basically requires, through one device or another, changing the price signal that we get from the way we use energy. Fossil energy needs to be expensive, and alternative energy needs, by contrast, to be cheaper. We can use subsidy policy to do some of that. We can use tax policy to do some of that. We can do a lot of things, but they have to add up to quickly sending a signal to consumers, to industry, to markets, that we need to move away from coal and gas and oil and towards wind and solar and other renewable technologies, many of which are now ready to take up that role if we can muster the political will.
Thanks very much for talking to us with today, Mr. McKibben.
Well, my pleasure.
And we've been talking to Bill McKibben, the environmentalist and author, and his new book, Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future, will be coming out in a few months. Thank you very much.
Take care.